Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Seeing in the dark doesn't mean the blackest of black dark, although it can. It means seeing the things that ordinary sight often overlooks. And I'll give you an example. When you walk out into the world in the outdoors, when you see the tiny little candles at the end of the blue spruce that are so moist and so fragrant, that's seeing. That's a kind of seeing in the dark. When you walk along outdoors and you see that the clouds are in certain shapes and forms that are pleasing to you or interesting to you, that's a way of seeing that's out of the ordinary of looking at little green boxes with numbers in them. When you notice that the tree swallows have come back, or the house wrens are up under the rafters, or the little chipping sparrows, you know, are back after having been away a long time, that's seeing in an unusual way. It's a way that is resonant with your body, your spirit, your soul, your mind, your whole being. When you notice that the flickers are outside, that's a form of woodpecker, and that they're hitting the metal gutters of the house going in the morning, early morning, often waking you up. You know that they're seeking a mate, and that's their way of gaining the attention of the ladies flying by. That is a form of seeing in the dark. When you see the tiny flowers that are underneath the longer buffalo grass, that's seeing in an unusual way. When you notice the nests that are along the side of the road, that are literally on the ground, like those of geese, for instance, that is seeing in an unusual way. And the psyche works that way too. The psyche is an enormous landscape, an outdoor landscape, into which there are many, many, many features that many people bypass because they're so much consumed by the whirl of life and the gyre of life. And the medial woman sees most everything because she pays attention from her soul, from her spirit, from her mind, from her body, from her heart, from her creative imagination, from her instincts, and from memory. So the medial woman is the one who stands between the world of the obvious and the world of the hidden, the world that is not so easily seen as people rush along. The value of standing as the medial woman nature is that one pulls forward to oneself unusual, beautiful, nourishing images, ideas, and inspirations. A medial woman is one who is able to know, like la que sabe knows, the one who knows, when it's time for all the creatures to fly away. She already has a sense that they're preparing and they're ready to go on the autumn, when the white pelicans go, or the blue herons begin to roost farther up than the warmer parts of the mountain range. When people are in that medial state, they not only see, but they anticipate as well. And anticipating what is to come next is one of our brightest and shiniest ideas around ceremony and ritual, for instance. We see when the child, man, starts to get his first little bristles up on his upper lip. We see when the young girl begins to just get a little fuller in the chest area than before. We see the time is commencing to create ceremony, to create congratulations, celebrations. And that's part of the medial nature as well. The one who knows, and more deeply even than that, the one who knows when it's time. Time to bring life and time to let things die. Time to change things. Time sometimes to kill things. Sometimes to heal and mend anything that can be brought back to life. So all of those belong to the medial nature. Because women are often caged early on in life by the culture. The overculture has expectations that the radiance and enormity of the feminine should somehow be squished or squashed or condensed down into a much smaller version. So it isn't as vast, it isn't as intense, and perhaps it isn't as scary for some people. What we find in myths and stories are maps on what has happened to the feminine nature, in this case, the medial nature, which knows because it knows. It anticipates because it's inbuilt. It senses and sees things that are outside just ordinary vision. That's the way a woman is born. But something can happen to her to interfere with those enormous gifts. And fairy tales are filled with situations like that. And that's why it's useful to study myths and tales to see, well, what happened to the feminine nature and what happens to redeem it or bring it back to life. For instance, this story. It's an ancient story told in Eastern Europe and in Russia. It is a story about a young man who was to be married. And he is going to be a groom, and he and his friend have prepared everything, including getting the very slender gold ring to give to the bride. Now, the bride lived far away, so the two men, the groom and his best friend, started walking through the forest to get to the bride's village for the marriage. And the first night, they decided to set up camp near a river. Now, at that river was a tree, a huge, enormous old tree. And one of its roots was sticking up out of the ground, and it almost looked like a bony finger sticking up out of the ground. And the groom took the golden wedding ring from his pocket and he put it on the bony looking root of the tree as though it were a finger, and he pronounced the wedding vow, which is, "Behold, you are consecrated to me with this ring according to the laws of Moshe Yad Israel, according to the laws of Moses in Israel." And he and his friend began laughing. He circled three times, saying the same thing over and over again, the marriage, sacred contract. And afterward, they were laughing so hard. I thought that was so funny, except all of a sudden the earth started trembling and shivering. And all of a sudden, the place where the stick with the ring on it was opened up in a great big zigzag, and a horrible thing they beheld: the corpse of a woman dressed in a long bridal gown. Oh my, they were so shocked, they backed away. She was held together barely in her bones by all the shreds of the silk of the wedding gown. Oh, they said, what do you want of us? And the corpse bride said, "You've done the wedding dance. You've pronounced the marriage vows thrice, and you have put the ring upon my finger. So now we are husband and wife. Now I want my rights as your bride." Oh, no. The two men, they ran for their lives. They ran and they ran and they ran to the bride's village, where they immediately contacted the rabbi. It's the most knowledgeable person in the entire village. And the young groom said, "Rabbi, Oh, I have a really important question to ask you. If by some chance you're walking in the woods, you know, one day, and you happen to see a tree root sticking out of the ground that kind of looks, you know, like a bony finger, you know, coming out of the ground, and you happen to have a wedding ring with you, and you put the wedding ring on the root, and you do the wedding dance, and you pronounce the wedding vows. Is that a real marriage? And the rabbi said, do you know of such a situation? Oh, no, it's just a question my friend and I had, that's all. And just then, a gust of wind came through the rabbi's study, and a clanking sound, and the corpse bride appeared in the doorway, saying, I lay claim to this man. He has placed this wedding ring, and she showed the rabbi her hand made of bones. He has pronounced the solemn vow of marriage with me. Ah, said the rabbi, Soon all the rabbis, dozens and dozens of rabbis of all the surrounding villages, had convened together, and they went into a long meeting while the two young men waited and waited. And the corpse bride waited too, saying so gently but firmly, I want to celebrate my life of my wedding night with my husband. Except those words scared the poor groom half to death. So the rabbis conferred and they conferred. And meanwhile, the real bride, the human bride, the living bride, arrived and wanted to know what on earth was going on. And her groom explained, we were out in the woods, and we saw a bony protrusion from the roots of the trees, and I put your wedding ring on that bony protrusion, and I pronounced the wedding vow. Behold, you are consecrated to me with this ring according to the laws of Moshe Yet Yisrael. Oh, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. And the bride began to weep. She said, my life is over. You've betrothed yourself to a corpse. How could you? Just then the rabbis came out and they announced, we think, reached an understanding. Did you put the gold ring on the finger of the corpse? And did you dance around the corpse three times? And did you promise the wedding vow in its entirety? The groom said, I did. And the young bride, the living bride, wept. And the corpse bride was thinking, well, maybe I'll have my life and my wedding night at last. The rabbi said, well, here's the thing. Since you did put the wedding ring on the finger of the corpse bride, and since you did dance three times in a circle, reciting the wedding vows, we have determined that this does constitute a proper wedding. This ceremony is sealed. You could hear across the villages practically the sigh of people's astonishment and horror. But then the rabbis announced, but even so, we have determined to something else that is more true than the wedding ceremony, and that is that the dead shall have no claim upon the living. Oh, the men wiped their mouths. The women cried regardless. The young bride said, oh, thank goodness. The corpse bride, however, said, oh no, my last chance for a real life. I'll never have my dream. It's gone forever now. And she collapsed onto the floor with a clank and tinkles of her bones. and it was truly pitiful. A heap of bones all wrapped with tattered wedding lace and silk, just laying there. But the young bride, the living bride, was overcome with pity, and she knelt down and she gathered up all the bones and all the torn silk, carefully arranged them all in order. And holding the corpse bride close, she said, "No, don't worry. I'll live the dreams for us. I'll live the hopes we have. I'll have the children we wanted. I'll have enough children for the two of us. And you rest, knowing that our children and our children's children will be loved and cared for and will never forget us." And the bride tenderly closed the eyes of the corpse bride and held her so gently and slowly, in almost like a step from a wedding march, she went down to the river, this fragile bundle, and laid her down in the shallow grave where she had come, and crossed her little arms across her bony chest and folded the wedding gown around her and whispered, "Rest, rest now. I will live the dreams. Don't worry. I will never forget you." And the corpse bride was at peace, and she somehow knew she would be fulfilled through this young living woman who could see past all the things that occurred that were difficult and horrifying, scary, that she could see that life could come even from this, even from the darkness. And so she covered over gently with earth and planted flowers over the grave and stones all around, each one carefully selected to commemorate that here lay one who had great hopes that would now be carried on by the living. So you see, Corpse Bride is a story that's based on actual circumstances. Long ago, when there was grave anti-Semitism, often bands of thugs would waylay a wedding party, and the bride would be the first to bear the future generations, and so they would kill her first. And then her people would bury her in her wedding gown. But in this story, which has that as a historical basis, also a story about a part of ourselves as women that had all the hopes and dreams and instincts and insights and the ability to see and hear in the dark, that was placed in another kind of darkness altogether, a darkness of deadness rather than a darkness of illumination and sight and hearing of the small, beautiful, gem-like things of this earth, as well as the beautiful life force that lives in every creature and every soul. And so, like the corpse bride, who coughed and coughed up dirt clogs when she first rose up out of the grave, she finally could speak her peace. And that's our story too. That whoever of us has been taken down to the grave by those who feared that we would generate new ideas, a new life, new innovations, new insights, no matter what, is a breaking of the silence, even though it's frightening at first, to say, "No, I still have hopes, I still have dreams, I still want life, regardless of what has occurred to me." That there's another side of our nature, the medial woman who says, "Good, thank you for telling me. I will live this out now. I will take all the hopes, the dreams, all the gifts, and I will unfurl them and unfold them in every direction. You, who were so confined, and so drained, rest now. Rest. I will take it the rest of the way. And that is the story of how the medial woman comes back to life. She who can see in the dark, just like the living bride could see way past all the consternation and all the horrification of the villagers, into the dream that the corpse bride still carried for bringing life into the world, for living dreams, for having hopes again. So the merit of seeing into the dark is in part to see what has died, what has been killed off way prematurely, what has not been allowed its proper life, and to take back the living life force out of that and to live it yourself now, according to what you see in the shadows of your own psyche, where there are green-tailed towhees and pygmy nutthatches that are still feeding their young, no matter what has happened to you. As you walk along the road, you are going to see the ring-necked ducks that are on the pond, you know, the mother duck. She goes forward and all of her little babies go behind her, and suddenly she changes directions and sails past them, and they suddenly all of them change directions and then paddle after their mother again. All these ways of seeing real life emerging, real life coming back again over and over again, season after season, all of these are our ways of seeing in the dark. The medial nature of the psyche is all, for many years, written about, the last 100 years particularly, in various people's work who happen to be depth psychologists or analytical psychologists. They are concerned with what is called also, amongst Aboriginal groups, la alma, the eyes of the soul, that which can see beyond the ego itself. Some people in metaphysics call this part of human nature the mediumistic. And I like the word medial because it tells that it's a part of us that stands in between two worlds, that can see into both worlds, both the world that is obvious, made of wood and rock and stone and human beings and bones, and the world that is invisible in some ways to the ego, but it can be seen and felt by the soul. This medial self, the one that stands between, can carry messages back and forth between the two worlds. In analytical psychology and developmental psychology, this aspect of all human beings would be called the instinctual nature. It is mysterious. It can be written about in volume after volume, and yet it can't quite be pinned down because it has to do with knowing something deep. In, you know, los huesos, in your bones, down inside yourself, knowledge about which way to go, about who is in peril and who is good. Knowledge that can tell us, if we listen to it, of things that would appear invisible to the ego, such as our own motives or the motives of others, for instance. So, Tony Wolf, who was a colleague of Carl Jung's, a psychologist who lived over 100 years ago and died in 1961, his colleague Tony Wolf was a woman who wrote about the nature of the psyche in what I think is a very poetic and lyrical but down-to-earth way. And one of the aspects that she named is called the medial woman, medial being the mediumistic aspect of the psyche, that knows what it knows, sees what it sees, hears what it hears, feels what it feels, and says it, puts it into action of some sort. Even though others all surrounding, you know, like the court of egos all around, might not be able to discern how this person ever figured these things out in terms of creating, unleashing ideas, creating political movements, resistances, flowering in many, many ways. Toni Wolff's work says that of the psyche, any psyche, male, female, does not matter, that there are several aspects. One is like a lover. It is something that is in love with all things on earth. I think Emily Dickinson was the poet who said, "O world, I cannot hold thee close enough." She was talking about being in love. With what? With water, sky, forests, trees, pathways. That kind of love. So that aspect is named as the hetaira. Often. It's spelled H-E-I-T-A-R-A, and don't please ask me very often how to spell things because I have several forms of dyslexia, and one of them is, I suppose, proof that a creator has a sense of humor. Let's make a writer who can't spell. That would be me. So, hetaira means the lover. And some people would like to take that aspect of psyche down into meaning only sexual love or love between bodies, but it's much larger than that. It's a large overarching sky over all kinds of love. So that is significant in the medial nature, because the medial nature, when it is drawn to act by knowing what it knows, seeing what it sees, thinking what it thinks, feeling what it feels, hearing what it hears, has to be tied to that other nature in order for whatever it knows and sees of the other world doesn't become twisted and distorted and put to uses that are not in service of the fullness of being. So these two natures, the one that loves everything, that hugs everything, embraces everything, wants to kiss flowers as they open, is interested in putting their arms around the shoulder of those who are suffering, those souls who automatically hold water in their hands and bring it close to their faces just to smell the beautiful scent of water, those souls who have that sense of life and life force within all things, and therefore have highly developed instincts, are, in our culture, in Western culture in particular, are looked at as insubstantive often, are looked at as people who really don't belong, who are often pushed to the edges, marginalized. As I used to say, people on the fringes are not really on the fringes often, as you know. They're on the frontiers. That the trees and the leaves and the flowers don't grow from the center, they grow from the edges. They grow from the very edges of things. The things that we see out of the edge of our vision, the things that we feel out of the very edges of our hearts, that are outside the regular purview of most people. That's where development, innovation, creativity, invention comes from. New ideas, ways of being that are different, better than they were before. So in the culture, there is the idea that the mystical life, that is, a life of the medial, is somehow unable to be made commerce out of, that somehow, because it cannot be bought or sold, which it cannot, and you can't go buy it somewhere, it is given to you as a gift at birth. That because it can't be exploited particularly, therefore it must not be valuable. However, in the greater creative movements of the world, in individuals and in groups, if that nature, the medial nature, is not present, culture, the very culture, dies. The heart of everything that has a heart begins to die and wither because it is nourishment. The medial nature is nourishment for the psyche and for the actions of people who feel it. In my family, and I have two families, one family is Mexicano and the other one is Mojor and Schwabian. They are a tribal group of people who grew up on the Danube River, the latter, and the former in some of the great volcanic areas in southern Mexico. And in each of those cultures, interestingly enough, there's a concept of that which steals the mediumistic nature away from people. And amongst the old tribal groups in each of those cultures, and incidentally in your culture also, no matter what your heritage is, if it's Polish or Irish, German, no matter what it is, Swedish, Norwegian, Danish, South American country, any part of this world, there are stories amongst your ancestors about this very thing, that the mediumistic nature should never be stolen away from anyone. In my Danubian, Schwabian family, there's a story called the Ölkönig, and it means the Earl King. Earl is spelled E-R-L, and then König is K-O-N-I-G, and it was pronounced in English, anglicized Earl King. And in the Earl King story, it's about a dark forest. The Earl King is a soul stealer, a bloodless, malevolent, claw-handed creature who thieves the minds and hearts of humans so they become hollowed, like the withered woods that the Earl King himself lives in. And so in the story, the way that it is told in our family, is that a father is riding through the forest on his horse, and he has his little son in his arms, and they're riding through the forest. The child, of course, has a vulnerable, childlike heart. And the father is more calloused, and he is, of course, older, and he's lived longer, and he's seen more. But suddenly, the little child says, "Father, it's behind us, something following us." And the father says, no, my son. There's nothing there. Nothing, there's nothing there. And the child's quiet a little more, and the horse just trots along in the dark forest. And suddenly the little child says, "Father, don't you see? Ölkönig, he's there, I can see him. Don't you see him?" And the father says, no, you don't understand, son. There is no such thing. There is no such thing. Just lean against me now and be quiet." And they continue trotting through the forest. And the little child says, "Father, don't you see? He has on his crown and has a long train on his gown." And the father says, no, my son. That's only the fog. You are only seeing the fog swirling, you know, and you see, you know, some of the branches in the trees, they look like a crown." And they continue to trot through the forest. And the child again says, "Father, look, the Ölkönig is close by our side. Don't you see? He is here." And all of a sudden, as the father says, no, it's only the mist rising over the plain, the horse senses and feels the Ölkönig, and he begins galloping as fast as it possibly can. And the father is holding on for dear life, and the child too. And the child is crying, Father, I tell you, the Ölkönig is here. And the father keeps saying, No, he is not. And finally, they arrive breathless, the horse wheezing at their destination, and the little child is dead in his father's arms. For the Ölkönig has stolen his father long ago, made it so that his father can no longer see the medial world, can no longer make sense of what the little child heart sees clearly, knows is a peril to itself. Child speaks pure. The father, in analytical psychology, we say the father as a symbol can represent the dominant culture that we live in, the one who tells us what to do, how to be, where to go, how to act, and so on. In this story, which incidentally is also a poem by Goethe, a very short, brief version of the story of the Urkönig, in this story, the father portrays exactly what many, many gifted people have experienced in culture, and that is that whatever comes to steal their gifts early on in life, no, no, don't jump, no, no, don't play, no, no, don't explore, no, no, don't look, no, no, don't see, don't experiment, don't think, don't ask questions, just do as I tell you to do, that the father in the Urkönig story reminds that this is an everyday occurrence in our lives, and something that Jung wrote about as having to be resisted. The idea of individuation, which is becoming one's own self entirely, and incidentally, that doesn't mean turning into a person who navel gazes. It means turning into a person who is so full and so rich that they overflow into the world, helping other hearts and souls to also become full human beings. Ser humano, as we say in Spanish. Ser humano, a true human being who is fully intact, with full ability to love, without shame, without apology, and a person who is able to stand at the center of both worlds, and to mediate, moderate back and forth between the two, passing knowledge back and forth. So, in this story, the horse, a symbol of the horse, an ancient, ancient idea. My Mojor father used to tell me that you had to be so careful when you had a horse who loved you, because it would literally run its heart out for you and kill itself. That a horse has such fealty, such loyalty to humans, humans that they love, that no matter how hard you ride them, they'll keep running and running and running, even to their own detriment, out of love for you, out of believing that you really have somewhere to go, something to see, something that's important to you. And in the Urkönig story, you see that even though the father is asleep, the instinctual psyche, as represented by the horse, is wide awake. After the child continues to say, but father, it's following, it's hurting, it's coming to take me away. Not the father, but the instinctual nature begins to gallop, begins to try to outrun what is in the culture that says, it's all right to live deadened, it's all right to live not in your fullest mane. It's perfectly all right to cut yourself off in every direction. That's perfectly all right. In fact, it makes you a really nice worker for other people. It makes you a really obedient person who behaves yourself. And yet, again, where do great ideas come from? Do they come from the well-behaved? Where do great ideas, great endeavors come from? Do they come from people who obey all the minutiae of life? Well, they don't. They come from the edges. They come from the frontiers. But one has to be alive in order to see them and hear them. And thus, we move into the idea again of how do you keep the medial nature alive, especially when you live in a culture that day after day after day, in so many ways, tells you, no, we're not going to talk about soul. This is the breakfast table. No, we're not going to talk about soul. This is the conference room. No, we're not going to talk about soul. I'm talking to you about our relationship. No, I'm not going to talk to you about soul because it has no relevance. You can translate. You can translate for yourself where this occurs daily in the life that you live. And as I said, Jung said that you have to leave the collective. And what he meant by that is the culture, that I'll have to turn away from the culture for a period of time and examine what is it that you're made of? What is it that you've brought here? What message, what challenge, what reason for being do you have for being on this earth? A lot of people think it's easy to be born. I don't think so. I think it's very rare. I think that when people are born, it's a miracle. Given how many times a soul lives, to be born, given all the things that can occur in between conception and birth and beyond, it's a miracle to be in this life. Given the wars that are fought in this world that murder children by the thousands day after day, it's a miracle to not only be born but to remain alive in this world. There's a reason that we carry with us. When so many fall left and right beside us, there's a reason for us to be doing what we do, thinking what we think, feeling what we feel, seeing what we see, and bringing it into a world that literally is starving to death. The Ölkönig is everywhere. And it's not meant to be a spooky thing that will be relegated to a little, sort of cute little figurine at Halloween. That's a very serious element in the psyche of any individual. Any of us carry the Ölkönig. And if we allow it to take us over, in part by not resisting where it touches us in our culture, then we become deadened and we pass that deadening on to others. So Tiresias is a Greek seer, S-E-E-R, and he is a blind man, and he is a really good example of the medial nature. He cannot see with his eyes, but he sees with his inner sight. And he is portrayed often as an old man with a big ragged beard and raggedy clothes, and he sort of lurches around in various ways. But if someone asks him a question, what do you think of this? Or can you tell me about that? Or I'm worried about such and such. He immediately says, this is what I see for you. I had a grandmother who used to say, it was a little scary. She used to say, I'm going to tell you your life. I'm going to tell your life to you. And usually it was in the middle of a conversation where you were happy-go-lucky, going along, going, oh, well, there really is no peril in the world and there really is nothing wrong and everything's just fine. And this person who's come into my life, even though they look a little strange and they have a blue beard and all the rest of that sort of thing, everything's going to be just fine. And she would say, I'm going to tell you your life right now. And she would get this look that would come over her face, and sort of her forehead would flatten a little bit like a copperhead snake. And she would look at me directly and she would say, this is not going to come to a good end. And if I tried to say, oh, no, oh, my, no, it's not true, she'd say, I'm telling you your life. And that is like Tiresias. Tiresias is a concept that is within all mythologies, and in Greek mythology, which is one of the few that we actually have lots and lots of written data from, he is the one who does not mince words about what he sees and would represent an aspect of the psyche inside ourselves that also should not mince words with us personally. I'm not so sure about walking around like my grandmother and saying, I'm going to tell you your life. I'm not so sure about that part, but I am sure that there is something in us that is like Tiresias that can see while it's blind. The heart might be blind. The sense of the future might be blind, but it still can see and it can tell the truth. And truth-telling is so much of the medial nature so that we know the way to go. It's like having signs that actually read right tell us which way to go instead of signs that say all the wrong things, so mislead us. So Tiresias is a person who has this really odd ability. He has the ability to be a man or a woman. And not many of us know many people like that in reality. But if we look at it psychologically, and there are people, of course, who are men and women both. And they are often found in culture of tribal groups that have people who have a feminine nature and a masculine nature both, and they might be both in the same body. And we have other people like that as well in the world. But in this particular view, I'm talking about having the ability to see so deeply and so well that the lines, the usual lines in culture of gender, are erased, so that you literally could think like a cultural male, for instance, or a cultural female, regardless of your gender. That you literally enter into the psyches of others who are not particularly like you, and be able to see, hear, sense how they move. It is the basis of one of the most dynamic and miraculous attributes amongst human beings. That ability to enter any soul, regardless of gender, tribal affiliation, race, is the very basis for compassion, the very basis for mercy for other souls. And so Tiresias is a good model of the medial nature that allows us to enter into seeing, feeling, hearing, listening, how others think, feel, conduct themselves in their lives, and understanding it without judgment, without saying that's right, that's wrong, it should be more this way, it should be more that way. None of that. Just understanding and having mercy and compassion for whatever is understood. One of the things that I would like to encourage you very much to do are practices. And I know there are a lot of, traditional practices like contemplation, meditation, prayer, affirmations. These are many kinds of practices. And I don't have a specific practice ever to tell a large group of people. I more so want to tell how to practice whatever it is that is strengthening for you. And as you know, if you look up the word practice in the dictionary, you sort of get the idea that practice means just do the same thing over and over again. But that's not what practice really is. And Tiresias and all others who practice the medial way of seeing and being in the world are practicing in an entirely different way. This is where Latin, you know, I went to Catholic school and with what I call my mad women in black, you know, my beloved nuns, and who were the most educated women of our time, unheard of, so educated. And they taught us Latin. And so we understand some of the origins of words as a result that are so magical. They're so magical when you remember back to what words really mean in the most medial sense. So in Latin, you can have practiones, which is to practice, but also there are other words that are interchangeable. They're like words you look up in a thesaurus. They're sympathetic words. They're just like that word, only different. So declamaciones is a way of practice, and it means to say aloud, to ora, to sing or speak aloud, as a means of remaining close to or remembering something. See, that idea of affirmation, whether it's ora pro nobis, whether you're singing it in Gregorian chant, or whether you're saying it out loud, whether you're writing it on a piece of paper, that might not be the most important part. The most important part is to say it, sing, speak it aloud in order to remain close to the medial nature, in order to remain close to the heart of the heart, in order to remain close to the immaculate. So that's one way of practicing, say aloud, to sing, to speak, but with the intent of remaining close. Another is exeratitonis. This means to train yourself, to, as a part of your training, to aim toward an end or an outcome. In other words, it's not the repetition of words, it's not the repetition of chant, it's not the repetition of music, it's not the repetition of dance. It's the aim that is the most important in the practice. And the excitement that one tries to find in that aim over and over again, so that it's not a matter of thinking a thought or holding a thought, or for that matter, not holding a thought, so that one becomes all calm, uncentered. It's actually in this kind of practice, looking for the center of fire, of excitement, of flame that goes with the medial nature. The medial nature is not a quiescent nature. If you are familiar with Espíritu Santo in any degree, which is the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost or Ruach, the mighty wind, you know, when people have been touched with the Holy Spirit, been touched with the practice of the medial nature, you always know, because their hair is flying off their head. Their clothes are on sideways. They're excited. They're warm. They're fired up. They're interested. They're alive, because the Urkönig has been absolutely dispersed. There is no place in that world for one who steals the spirit. So practices are not idle. They're preparatory in order to bring you straight into the red beating heart of what excites the soul, what allows sight, knowledge, feeling, all of those things. And that is what Tiresias is, as is Cybele. Cybele is a Greek goddess who is considered the Mater Grande, or the Madre Grande, of the entire universe. She's a Greek goddess, and she is medial. Her ability to see what people, others, need, what they need for their healing, what they need for their hope, what they need for flesh and blood, but more particularly for the grace and the grandeur of the development of their own psyches, is her particular province. And so she too is a seer, an S-E-E-R. And she is a person who has a dedication of love to other human beings. She would be, perhaps in Asian mythology, she would be similar to Kuan Yin. She would be the one who says, I have lived my lifetime as a perfected being, but I will not go to nirvana, or I will not go to heaven. I will remain in some way in touch with earth and its people until every last soul is without pain, every last soul is fully realized. And this is Cybele. She is a person who also guides people on their journeys. She is in some of the Greek stories about great seafaring journeys. She is the one who tells, go here, go there, don't go here, don't go there, don't speak to that person, but go to this person instead and say X to them, and all will be well. The idea behind the Cybele as this one who is the great compassionate one toward others was that the ability to even sense the medial nature immediately makes a person into one who gives and gives. And the giving is not, it doesn't wear you out. It doesn't fatigue you. In fact, in some sense, perhaps, it might cause the body to not sense fatigue as easily as it might normally, and maybe that would be good or bad depending on what the person's condition actually is physically. But for the most part, it is a kind of engendering of others that literally causes the person who's giving to feel radiant, to feel that they are in themselves truly. And Cybele and her great mother attribute is radiant. You've probably seen figurines of her that have been dug up at archaeological sites. She has very broad shoulders and very large breasts and large hips and large thighs and little teeny tiny ankles and little teeny tiny wrists and just a regular size head. And there is this delicacy to the Cybele. There's this delicacy to the one who can see far. They could be hurt, their little wrists and ankles. They could be broken. They could be harmed. But there's this abundance to them at the center of the body, too. And this center of the body is one of the places that some of the oldest rituals focus on, is to bring all light, all nourishment, all energy straight into the middle of the body, to make it not little or disappear or invisible, but to make it enormous, to make it big. And you think about, well, what's in the center of the body? The viscera, certainly the heart. And since time out of mind, all of your people, all of my people have said that's the seat of the soul as well, the center of the body. So Cybele, in her way of being a seer, is a mother. And a mother is a person who protects, nourishes, shelters, heals, picks up from the side of the road those who have been kicked aside, and helps altogether. In other words, her vision, her insight, her standing between the two worlds is meant to help and to heal. As opposed to another seer that I wanted to tell you about tonight, whose name is Medea. And Medea is also in the Greek mythologies, and she is a person who is a sorceress. And a sorceress is not exactly what you've seen in the movies or what we've been fed as, you know, some rather very strange, odd person. I think most of us are very strange, odd. You don't have to be a sorcerer to be strange, odd. But it is meant to be a person who ensorcels, meaning that they can talk about things the way they really are, and they can change the mood of people that they're speaking to, and they can cause people to focus on a far, far away horizon that is not in this moment, that they have the ability to cause others' imagination. I see. Different than the mother who heals and helps, different than Tiresias, who's going to tell you your life, as it will be if you take the next step. Different than those. So she is a person who is an inspiratrice, I would say. That is a person who, when you're near them, they make you begin to feel like you want to create. That life as it has been doesn't have to be as bland or as torn up as it has been. That other things can happen now. And that's because the person who has the gift, and I believe all are born with the gift, but of course different things happen to different gifts after we're born, that the person who has the gift of being an inspiratrice will, in so many ways, fire other people to not conform, but to perform the greatest creative deeds in life according to their soul sights.
Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.